Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's first session of ApacheCon Europe 2016. We have Jim Jagielski today with us. He'll be speaking on enterprise lessons learned from the open source community. Please give a round of applause for him, and we'll begin with the session. Thank you.
I haven't done anything yet to warrant the applause, but thank you anyway. First of all, thank you everyone for attending. I know there are a lot of really, really cool sessions going on now. I also know this was after lunch, and this is actually siesta time. So the very fact that you're here, 2:30 in the afternoon, I really, really do appreciate it. I try to have very, very free-flowing kind of presentations. I want these to be discussions, dialogues, not monologues. So if you have any questions, you know, during the time, please just raise your hand and ask. Don't wait until the very, very end. I'd much rather have a real nice little dialogue going on, because chances are very good that your question is going to spur a question in somebody else. A little bit about me. I did co-found the Apache Software Foundation. I've been on the board of directors since day one. Really, really excited and happy about that. I don't know why, but they keep on electing me onto the board. I've also served on a number of other boards, you know, OSI and things like that. But I really consider myself a developer, a hacker at heart. I didn't get into this for the administrative parts of it. I got into it because of the development, because of the open source community, because I was really drawn to doing that out there. To pay the bill, since almost, I hope everyone knows that the ASF really doesn't pay for development, Capital One, the bank in the US, I'm a senior director in there. And this talk is actually kind of interesting because open source and intersourcing is something we're starting to get inside of Capital One. Capital One is really making this transition to be what's called a tech company that just happens to be a bank. So embracing intersource, embracing the concept of open source is very, very, very key to us out here. In general, the idea of intersourcing is that there are some development lessons learned that you can have inside of the open source community that you can actually take and bring in-house inside your enterprise IT divisions to actually leverage some of those advantages. So basically, the lessons that we learn inside the open source community of how you develop, how you collaborate, how you reach consensus and things like that, okay? These are also techniques that you can bring inside your internal IT development shop, inside your engineering shop. And not only inside of your development shops, but also in places like marketing and PR and things of, and documentation, things of that nature. And Jackie, please stand up. Joanne, I'm sorry. Joanne is doing a talk right after mine, which follows on to that actually concept inside of it. So what I'm gonna try to do is talk about the principles behind it. A lot of people, when they talk about intersource, focus on the techniques. These are the things you have to do to embrace intersourcing. And although I think that has some value, I also think that if you focus on the tools instead of the reason behind the tools, you're gonna get lost. So I'd like to focus a little bit more on the principles behind intersourcing, and then we'll talk about the actual techniques and stuff like that. A real quick primer on open source. I'm sure many people already know what open source is, but just in case, because there is this alignment between intersourcing and open source, open source is really so-called this new way of doing development. But really, when you think about it, when computers were basically maybe a quarter of the size of this room, and the computer itself was the software dongle, that was the thing that was really, really important, was the computer, that was expensive. People shared and collaborated on software all over the place. So the whole idea of software being something which is very, very closed, that we don't collaborate on, is actually relatively new. It only happened when the computers themselves became very, very cheap and inexpensive and stuff like that. No, I thought a question pop up, okay? And another thing to remember is that the key technologies of the web and the cloud are really based on open source. So why is that? Why did open source do this? Why was open source able to drive this kind of innovation inside there? Well, basically the reason why is that it enabled this concept, this culture of sharing. it enabled engineers and developers who I think are really artists at heart to hone their craft and skills with like-minded individuals. It really created an environment and a culture that forced collaboration and consensus-based development processes out there. Now, open source, really, to be technical, only needs to be software under an open source license. But what we're going to be talking about is actually this methodology, you know, the governance models behind that. And those are the main key takeaways when you start talking about open source and how you relate to inner sourcing itself. In the EU, you use the term free software a lot more often than the term inner source. For the sake of this discussion, they're pretty much the exact same thing. Let's not worry about the difference behind them. Just remember that everything I'm saying about open source can basically also be related to inner source as well and free software. So the basic tenets, the basic ideas of open source is that you have access to all this information out there. And we'll see how this access is very, very important. Now, I won't talk a lot about the different community models associated with open source because there are different ones. These are defined by how open source communities grow and develop. One is sort of like the walled garden environment. When you think about how IT is done in development shops now, this is kind of like the walled garden. Okay, only the specific team has access to the code. They're the only ones who drive the code. They're the only ones whose patches and improvements and design decisions are inside the code itself. There's really no interaction, externally. You're really not sharing any information. It's a sort of like a silo inside there. So your teams aren't sharing a lot of information. In the open source model, there's a way of breaking out that a little bit further, and it's called a benevolent dictator for life. That's what that acronym is for. Linux is most probably the best example of that. And the way the Linux works is that it's a community-based environment. Everyone has a say, but there is a stopgap, which is Linus. And if he doesn't like it, then he gets a veto power to be able to overrule what people say. But it still enables a lot of open development and still enables a lot of communication. Linus is there basically to make consensus when the community itself can't do it. In a lot of cases, the best model, the model that's used at the Apache Software Foundation, the model that is based on the concepts of the Apache way, and there are a couple talks today and later on tomorrow about the Apache way, I certainly encourage people to look at that, is about this idea of meritocracy. Now, in some areas, the idea of meritocracy has a bad word, has a bad connotation to it. People think it's basically reinforcing a ruling class inside of an open source development project. But the real idea about meritocracy is those who do more get to have more influence and more say inside of it. So let's just talk a little bit about why inner sourcing matters and how inner sourcing can be taken into IT. Well, first of all, why do you want to do this? Why do we see so many companies and corporations and other entities out there want to learn more about this concept of inner source? Well, mostly because if they're lucky enough, they've encountered how it works in open source environments. They look and see how open source projects are growing and thriving, how they're moving innovation, and they're saying, how can this really uncollected, uncoordinated mass of people drive such innovation? How can you have these people who are really self-motivated create such incredibly reliable, robust, and secure code? And how can we bring those, how can we do that internally? And so that's what inner sourcing is about, is to be able to gain these efficiencies. Okay, not only are you using inner sourcing so you can further leverage open source, so you can figure out what open source projects to bring inside, but also to ensure that your talent, that your development talent, that your engineers, who are usually your most expensive employees, are doing what they want to do. You want to have them use their skills and their talents on the things that differentiate you as a company. You don't want them recreating the wheel if you can go and just use the wheel from somebody else and have them focus on the so-called special sauce or secret sauce that makes your company different. Not only is that important, but also it enables other teams to innovate and collaborate. You're able to share talent from specific teams out here. Engineers in general get bored when they're working on the same thing time after time. And that's another reason why open source became very, very popular is because it enabled people who were bored with their day jobs to do things as on a volunteer basis, things that were important to them, things that have allowed them to grow in their skills. And by leveraging that internally, you get an economy of resources. Not only is your specific team growing and developing and creating your code, but other teams, you know, and other developers from other teams are also coming in, bringing in fresh ideas, bringing in a new set of eyes. And as we all know, the more eyes that are looking at code, the better it is, the more robust, reliable it is out there. Now, all of these things help you bring products to market faster. At the end of the day, especially if you're a software company, or even if you're just any kind of company at all, by leveraging IT to its core, you're able to, again, focus on what's important to your company. It enables you to bring new products and new services to market faster, which is really what's important. You want to be able to leapfrog over your competitor. You want to have a tune into what's going on in your customer environment and being able to bring what they want to market faster. Not only that, but there's also the really cool desire and need that if you're going to fail, if you're going to come up with a product or a service which is not accurate, you want to be able to do that quickly. You don't want to spend a lot of time and a lot of resources and a lot of energy in creating a product which is going to fail. You want to be able to know sooner rather than later if you're going to be successful or not. And again, leveraging inner source allows this fail faster sort of mentality, that you're not wasting time on a product or a service that isn't going to succeed out there. And another thing which I think is incredibly important is the whole attract and retention of great talent. Again, developers are artists. They are people who want to be able to do fun and cool stuff. And if there isn't an opportunity for them to do that in their work environment, chances are very good you're not going to be able to hire them. And if you are able to hire them, they're not going to stay. They're going to go to another company or entity which provides this sort of like environment for them to be able to do inner sourcing. A lot of people think about how to drive people. And this is a great quote from The Little Prince, and I think really goes to the heart of the matter. This is the actual quote, but this is the one that people most probably say a lot more. And again, it focuses on the idea of it being a community. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood and divide up the work and give orders, but instead teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Drive the culture part of it, okay? And they will self-direct. They will do what they need to do as a group, as an entity, as a collaborative collection of people to do what they need to achieve their goal. It's a much easier way to do that, and inner sourcing really, really provides that. So the basic principles behind inner sourcing are these, and I'll go into a little bit of detail all of those. And in a lot of ways, this is sort of like the transitional phase. At the very, very top is culture, and I think that is most probably the most important part of inner sourcing. If you can get culture right, then everything else will pretty much naturally flow. If you can't get culture right, then you might have to focus on these things to really gain some of the benefits and stuff like that. All of these slides are going to be up on SlideShare, by the way. So if some of this stuff is if I'm going through it too quickly or something like that, it's all going to be up there. As I said before, the whole idea, especially in a lot of big IT shops, the concept of inner sourcing is a cultural mind shift. People are used to and familiar working on their own particular project. Managers are very, very comfortable knowing exactly what their employees are working on, exactly at what particular time. That's how you do performance reviews and stuff like that. They're looking at lines of code and things like that. So there has to be this idea this has to be this buy-in that we are going to do things differently, that we are going to create a culture, an open culture, where it's okay for people to share information. It's okay for people who are working on one particular project to also spend some time in other projects inside there. We're going to create a culture where managers are more focused on making their employees happy so they produce, so they have an environment to innovate, rather than worrying about lines of code and hours and things like that. That can be incredibly hard to do, especially if you're a long-standing company who's been doing it this way for years and years and years. This change in culture is very, very difficult. But if you're a company that is already embracing open source, if you're leveraging it in some particular way, you've already made that step. You've already allowed this external entity that you really may have very, very limited control or influence over to actually do some of that direction for you. You actually have an external community somewhat in the driver's seat with you. You've already made that step. So embracing that culture internally really will not be as difficult as it is. And there are a lot of success stories. There's a website called innersourcecommons.com. I don't know if I have a pointer to that on this or not. But it's a group of companies such as Capital One, PayPal, Autodesk, Google, who are all embracing innersourcing and are creating white papers and information to make it easier for people to embrace it internally. Okay. The main idea behind culture is to create a list of expectations and behaviors. This is what we expect. We expect you to be open to contributions. We expect you to be open to other people not within your team who are actually driving things. And culture, an open culture, a culture which encourages this kind of sharing, will naturally drive communication, open communication inside of that arena. Communication itself, in the same way the culture is actually core and foundational to the idea. If you don't have a communication mechanism or a communication mechanism or a communication culture inside of your company, which is public as far as company-wide, which is transparent, you know, you're not having behind closed door meetings or design meetings and things like that. If you're not having that, then you're really disenfranchising people. And that's another feature that we saw in the open source community is that in general, because of the developers for these projects are widely diverse, geographically diverse, culturally diverse, you want to make communication as easy and as possible, as seamless as you can, but also as open and transparent. For example, at Apache, all development is done on dev at whatever the name of the project is. It's all openly available to people. It's archivable. This means that I could come into any project that I'm interested in, look at the archives for that email list, and find out why decisions were made, find out how to get involved, find out what was going on. Okay, I'm not disenfranchised from that. Okay, so the whole idea of communication being central and core, encouraging communication is very, very important. And we see that the archivability of it, the publicly transparency, drives towards it as well. Another topic which is incredibly important, and I'm not going to give it due justice, but I think the next speaker will, is the whole idea of tribal knowledge. This is just sort of like, you know, ingrained knowledge that as an employee or as a developer, you just know. You know, you've been there long enough and you just know certain things. Well, that's not good if the idea behind inner sourcing is to encourage people to be able to join very, very quickly and very, very readily. They don't have the time, and you don't want to afford the time to have them gain sort of like this knowledge. So by documenting tribal knowledge, by making sure that there is huge amounts of documentation available so everybody knows why decisions are being made, not just developers, but also marketing, but also PR, also the business leaders. You know, the people at that level also need to know why these decisions are being made. And so communication also evolves down into this documentation, this sharing of resources, this sharing of tribal knowledge, so that everyone feels part and parcel of the team, that everyone feels as if their insights are just as valuable. So transparency, obviously, is a corresponding factor of this. And the thing is, that when you think about it just in a software sort of idea, transparency is just the concept that everyone has access to the source code, that it's very, very easy to find some tools or projects that you're working on internally that you might be interested in. Obviously, you can't reuse code internally if you can't find it, if you can't see it. And you see that a lot, especially in large companies with all these silos of developers, is that 9 times out of 10, they're recreating software where they could be sharing, and they're wasting a lot of time, a lot of resources in doing that. So being transparent about that, not just inside your team, but in the company at large. We are working on this. Is anyone else working on it? Okay, we have some ideas. This is where you can find what we're working on. Please critique it. Please let us know what's going on. And welcoming that sort of transparency inside there. Again, it kind of feedbacks in the communication part of it, is that your developers will be creating this software for other people to do peer reviews on. They have to be comfortable with that sort of transparency. And that's the sort of transparency that helps drive the innovation, the energy that we see inside of open source. So transparency is incredibly, incredibly important. And you can't really have the idea of collaboration, true collaboration, unless you're transparent. You can't collaborate on something if these people know more about it or know secret things about it than these people inside here. And so, yes?
Just curious, you had this comment on the previous slide about you can't reuse what you can't see. Do you know, among the companies you're familiar with, which of them actually do things like let all employees see all code?
The question was, how many companies out there that I'm familiar with allow all employees to see all code? A growing number of them do. Obviously, a lot of people are moving to enterprise GitHub. That's just the way the nature of the beast. And whereas before there would be specific teams that just had rewrite access to their specific repos and not anything else, they're really opening up to a lot more. There are, of course, always going to be cases, and especially Capital One, which is a federally regulated bank, that there are some parts of our code base that can't be publicly shared internally, that has to be secure, that has to be considered differently. And that's okay, that's no problem, okay? But there are huge swaths of other pieces of code which aren't required about that. The issue with having all this code available out there is that it's very, very difficult to find it. And that's the problem that I think that we haven't come up. Every company is doing it differently. Every company is creating their own specific, repo crawler or, Dev Hub or Dev Exchange or something like that to be able to find software projects which are going on internally. That is a growing issue. And that's something which I'd like to see something be open sourced and help other people collaborate on. So it is growing, but unless you think about that, if you are doing it and you should open up to, a much more open, transparency as far as repos are concerned, make sure you spend time thinking ahead of how can we make sure that people have access to this all this transparent information rather than making it difficult. Because if it's difficult to find information, people aren't going to reuse it. So even if it's transparent, you can say, hey, it was there. I couldn't find it. It doesn't help. So transparency without searchability, I guess, is really not very, very good. So as I said before, transparency kind of leads to or drives the concept of collaboration. because it provides the ability to have commonality, common goals, common desires, common end games, you know, common design decisions inside there. It allows people in widely diverse areas inside of the company to see connections. See connections between what's going on in this team and in that team, connections that you may have not noticed before, which could drive a new product or a new service. Okay, those are the kind of things that really drive innovation, is being able to look at what other people are doing and figuring out, how can I leverage those to create something new and different? You know, collaboration is all about enabling those connections between the people and between the projects inside theirs. Collaboration, true collaboration, and as I said before, a lot of these principles are really based on the Apache Way. So I really encourage you to read up on the Apache Way. It's no secret that that's the case. But collaboration itself is basically core of what Apache is, what meritocracy is that we're all working on this together. There is that sense of driving back the whole idea of community. Collaboration encourages that. It encourages contributions. By making it easier for people to collaborate, they're going to contribute. They're going to share back. They're going to go and try different things. They're going to, you know, help other developers out and things like that. Feedback and dialogue is also part of what collaboration is about. I've mentioned before the whole concept of peer review. Okay, collaboration also drives that. And finally, when you get into the collaboration, when you get down to that, you have a sense, finally, of community. If you're familiar with the ASF, our semi-formal mission statement is community before code, or community before code. The idea being is that if you create and foster a healthy, viable, long-term community, the software, the project, the documentation, the marketing material, all that will sustain itself. You focus on the health of community, and the product that that community creates benefits from that, becomes long-term sustainable, becomes robust, reliable, becomes very, very secure. Community is the focus that we're looking towards. It ensures and creates this durability that the communities grow and evolve. Okay, it's not based on a single person or a single group of persons. The community itself is the species that survives. Yes?
I assume a lot of this is on a private repo, a lot of these enterprises. Are you seeing any direction in terms of the public, the people
that
want to pull requests,
GitHub? The question was, a lot of these repos are most probably private internally. Are we seeing a movement towards making them more public? And we are. You see a lot of companies, especially the known players like Netflix and stuff like that. Even Capital One is creating a public repo for things that we think the community would be interested in. The problem with going public too early is that there might be software that you're creating in internally, which is good for you, not really suited for anybody else. And so when you put that out on the public archive and you're seeing no contributions, no pull requests, it kind of like gives a bad signal. It's sort of like, yeah, we just threw this over the fence, we're not going to worry about it. So although I'm always pro pushing stuff into public, if you don't think it's going to be a community, or there's not the potential for a community to build around it, why do it? There really isn't a need for it, because as I said before, it could backfire. Here it is, you're trying to do a good thing, and this is great, and if it just lies fallow there, it kind of like looks bad. Great question. And this basically comes down to the point of meritocracy, is that inside of your community, there will be people who stepped up to the challenge to be role models, mentors. These are the people who will help guide new people, encourage them to contribute to your inner source project, take them under their wing, show them, the pull request was great, but unfortunately, it caused this issue, and work with them on doing that. This is something that, again, people want to go and create. You want to be known as a mentor inside of your environment. You want to have that recognition, have that reward And management needs to be able to provide that inside there. And of course, meritocracy itself drives back into communication. So it's sort of like this the circle of life. You know, if your mentors will ensure that you're doing it right, the people who are involved in the community, who love meritocracy, will make sure that you don't go off the train tracks. So some of the techniques involved in doing that, in culture, I guess the best is just be the model. Be the example for your community. Try to drive it. Try to, you know, practice what you preach inside there. Make sure that all the decisions are done in the open as possible. Now, of course, this is a spectrum. Not everything we recommend, not everything I recommend is going to be 100% suited to your environment, but you'll be able to pick and choose some of these things out there. So these are some of the techniques that you can use inside of your culture to do that. The process is, again, make it easy to participate in a community. If you do have, if you are using GitHub Enterprise, open it up so everyone has at least read privileges, you know, to it. Everyone can look around and find out what's going on. Another big thing about collaboration is that chances are very good that your existing infrastructure really isn't well suited for the kind of open and public transparent collaboration you want to be looking on. For example, you might be using face-to-face meetings. If you're an agile shop, that's kind of like, you know, gospel. You know, you have face-to-face meetings inside there. Aligning inner sourcing with agile can be somewhat difficult because here it is, your focus on face-to-face, you know, synchronous meetings where decisions are made right there. You're immediately disenfranchising people who are out there. So make sure that you're spending time investing in resources to make it easier for people to collaborate. If you don't have, for example, Enterprise GitHub, maybe look into it. Maybe look at, you know, GitLab or something like that. Apache Alura, which is sort of like the foundation, which is for SourceForge. Fantastic thing to leverage. Very, very simple and easy to use. There are these tools available to you to be able to create that. Communication and transparency, again, leads back into that. Avoid face-to-face meetings as much as possible. If you do have them, make sure they're rare, and make sure whatever decisions are made, you bring back to an archivable list, whatever that list could be. I really don't like and been pushing the idea of getting away from things like Slack or even IRC and things like that, because it encourages people, even though it is archivable, it's not very easily searchable. You know, you've got this long stream of consciousness going on inside there, and it's very, very difficult to pick the thread that's going on inside of certain things out there, unless you create a separate channel just for this and archive it. Email is really, really nice because it's set up for that. It doesn't disenfranchise anyone. It's asynchronous. You can be 6 hours away and still feel as if you have a valid contribution to make inside there. So if you are using IRC or in Slack or HipChat or something like that, that's okay. But don't make it primary. Again, remember, if this is the way that we're making decisions, and it's basically not letting some people help make those decisions, or they only know about it after the fact, they're not going to want to get involved. They're not going to want to spend their time to be able to, their time and resources to help you out when they're really not given the opportunity. When you make the barrier to entry for contribution too high, people are not going to leap over that. Okay, make it as low as possible out there. And, you know, certainly, you know, encourage larger audience and stuff like that. Yes?
What about the break the build chain kind of stuff in enterprise?
I'm sorry?
The break, you know, you broke the build and,
Perfect timing. You were looking at the slides, weren't you? No. That's another thing that you need to invest is build and test tooling. What you want to make it, you know, what I like to say is that your QA team, basically, here it is, test it and get back to us, they should go away. They should be people who are creating testing environment, testing tools, unit testing, and things like that, so that anybody can come in I have a code base, I want a new feature inside there, I'm gonna try it out, make sure that my test works, make sure my functionality works, make sure it doesn't break anybody else, okay? Right now, that's really not the way it's done. You know, people are responsible for their own code, you dump it, you throw it over the wall to QA, okay? So you're gonna need to spend some time and resources in creating that kind of environment, the kind of environment where it's brain dead easy for people to contribute back and make sure that things aren't broken and things like that. And so that's why I've recommended having your QA team do that. QA shouldn't be seen as a separate function, but basically part and parcel of the development process itself. They are really well suited to creating the sort of like these unit testing codes and make it part of your CI/CD, chain. It's that every time something's going on, it gets, it gets checked and things like that. Another thing which you see a lot of people moving towards, semi-controversial, I guess, but if you break it, everybody heard if you break it, you bought it, okay? If you break it, you're the one who gets the 3 a.m. beeper, okay? Nowadays, you can check that out, okay? Something broke, who was the last person to touch it before it broke? They get the call. That makes that sense of responsibility much more personal to them. Again, you want to create this community environment. If the whole idea behind QA is I'm just developing for the code, I don't have to worry about once it's on production, it's not my problem. You're creating this artificial barrier between teams. So think about that. There might be some kind of environments that you can create. Yes.
So I agree with everything you're saying. One thing I'm worried about though is, for instance, suppose someone comes in and says, hey, I have this great new code that is able to read data from some system, and I'm worried about raising the bar for contribution to say, oh, this has to be tested to our standards, versus accepting it and then fixing it up, but potentially letting it sit there and be wrong.
Right. Right. So the question was how. Strict do you have to be about it going through this test phase? And certainly, again, we're living in a very, very different environment in DevOps where it's pretty much, hopefully, you're in an environment where it's very, very easy for you to roll things back. And so this is a known good state, this is a bad state, you can roll back, and then we'll triage later on. That's another very, very valuable, technique is using the tools, available to you out there. What we try to do is make sure that people know what this test environment is and that part of the approval process to get something in is that you have to provide a test case. Basically, test that your functionality, works the way it should. I won't go into most of these techniques inside here. Some of them will be quite easy. I do want to go into just some awareness issues in the this is a cultural change. It could be very, very difficult for people to make and accept this change inside there. So pick the right opportunities, pick the right code that should be inner source, pick the right code that should be open source, for example. Don't try to do it all at one, everything open, everything doesn't work. Also, remember that this isn't an opportunity for engineers to go off and do whatever it is they want to do. There has to be a business focus inside here. There has to be accountability for what they're doing. And there has to be some control issues inside there. That is something that certainly managers, people managers, are very, very concerned about. And chances are very, very good that you're going to get some resistance. A lot of the ideas is, hey, it's working fine. It ain't broke, so we're not going to worry about it. Communication can be annoying at first. Be prepared for that. People may not like it. Managers may not like it. The whole administrative, trivia associated with it are issues to be worried about. Again, seek people who have done that, who are doing this before, and help them help you out. Again, innersourcecommons.com is a really good example. In here, on the slides, as I said before, they're going to be on slide share. I've got some examples of choosing the right opportunity. Some of them might be applicable to your environment. But remember, even though you're doing this doesn't mean you're removing the whole idea of accountability. You're maintaining that. The code and the DevOps tools that you're providing allow you to do this really in a way that you haven't been able to before. So you have the ability to really fine-tune what that accountability is, as well as the control. So leverage those tools to make sure that happens. Okay. The company value needs to drive the community and not vice versa. Again, open source is nice that it has this nirvana, that the community is everything, that we don't have to worry about release cycles or things like that. We don't have shareholders to worry about. We don't have to worry about making money. Businesses do. Take the ideas, take the principles, take the handful of techniques that work for you and bring those in-house. Don't try to do everything because it's going to be just a huge mess. My last slide, just some final takeaway thoughts for you to think about. A community is not the same as a team. Okay, a team is told that you are a group. A community self-organizes. This is what you want to try to create. You want to try to create a group, a troop, a collection of people who self-identify as part of that group. Okay, team doesn't do that. Community does. Sometimes just calling it a community internally is enough. It makes this cultural change. You think about things differently just by a simple change of a word, okay? Also, contribution and these changes are work. Don't expect it to be free. There are going to be some changes that you need to make, some infrastructure resources and updates and things like that, that will, at first blush, seem stupid. Oh my God, I can't believe we're spending money to do this. You will quickly, and again, there are white papers to show this, quickly achieve your return on investment on these things. Even if it's just retaining talent. We all know how expensive it is to interview developers, how problematic it is when they leave, to recreate new teams and pull people in. Really, that is one of the key features that can't be diminished inside here. Okay, and transparency is not a threat. A lot of people do think about that. A lot of people are very, very concerned about that. Certainly, complete open transparency is a problem. And again, I'm speaking as someone who works for Capital One. There are things that we do that cannot be federally, legally cannot be open. We've got to maintain the secrecy, customer information and things like that. Okay, so just because some things are transparent doesn't mean that everything needs to be transparent. But conversely, just because some things need to be private doesn't mean everything needs to be private. So that's it. This is my Twitter handle, so if you want to follow me, I'd be more than happy to. If you need to contact me for anything, if you have questions, comments, feedback, or things like that, please use any of these emails. If it has to do with how Capital One is doing intersourcing, I prefer you use the Capital One email address. As I said before, all these slides will be up by later on today, up on SlideShare. I've got it as like quarter after, so I think we're pretty close to the end. We might have time for maybe one question or so.
We have time for two questions, I think, 2 to 3 questions. Any questions?
Any questions?
Yeah, you want to do things the Apache way, get everything on list and so on.
Yes, I do.
Deprecate IRC and Slack, or at least relegate them to a minor role. But sometimes the community has other ideas, wants to do everything on IRC and Slack. That's the community.
Yeah, that is true. The point was, you're on the mic, so I don't need to repeat the question. It is true that sometimes for the greater good, you may need to say, we understand that you love Slack. We understand that you love HipChat. Maybe it's not the best tool for what you want to do. Maybe there is no need. Maybe your company is small enough, centrally located, that everybody's in the same time zone. You know, and so using something like that makes sense. A lot of cases, you have people in vastly different time zones, especially if you're a company that has, you know, is US-based and EU-based, okay? Those kind of things can be difficult. Sometimes you may need to make some executive decisions for the betterment of open collaboration, open communication that restricts or at least has conditions associated with use of synchronous communications. It's difficult. You know, a lot of people would say, "Oh man, this is all about developer empowerment," and here it is, you're kicking the developer and saying, "No, you can't have that. You can't have that sweet toy. You love Slack, but no, I want it." You know, but again, at the end of the day, it's a business. And at the end of the day, if you have a justifiable reason for it, they may not like it, but they may accept it.
We've just been discussing that in bar camp upstairs this mm-hmm. morning, and I've been wrestling with this problem with respect to a podling.
Right. Okay.
Any other questions?
So can you comment on specific policies, company policies to encourage meritocracy?
Mm-hmm.
For the Apache projects, people gain fame worldwide because it's public, so you contribute more, mm-hmm. and that's your currency. You get recognition, love, and
right.
smiles and stuff. But inside the company, it's still closed enough. The group is small, and if you contribute more, you want more monetary compensation for that, more money. So how to marry the corporate promotion policies and meritocracy, or any other policies that promote meritocracy?
That's definitely true. And that is most probably one of the most common issues and concerns when you're moving from one management style to another, is that this you know, organizationally, developer A is in this team working on this project. She is spending a lot of time working on this project, okay? Is that okay? How do I go and account for that? You know, should I be upset that she's spending so much time here? And what it does, it drives management to, again, in the same kind of communication, collaboration that you're having inside of developers, it kind of like it forces that at a managerial level as well, is that you've got to get more, okay, my employee is working on certain other things as well. What is their feedback? What is their value to this project as well? So it does require a change from management structure and management style to be able to do that. And you just have to be aware of that, you know, as you work on, you know, as you make this transition, is that management will change. Another thing is that it means that a manager must be really more involved in what's going on inside these teams, okay? You know, a manager's duty is not just to wait until the end of a quarter or whatever and go through. They need to be involved. And certain aspects of inner sourcing allow them to be much more in tune to what's going on universally throughout these teams. You know, and I think Joanne's talk will be talking about, you know, partly, you know, some of that, is that this open collaboration, this transparency is great for the developers and the development process, but everyone else inside of the company can leverage and benefit from that. And managers can as well, because they'll have much more of a view on what other teams are doing and how their particular employee is making a contribution externally.
Any last questions?
Thanks. Okay, I also work for a very open company where we do everything through email communications.
Mm-hmm.
And what we realized is that sometimes teams need this private space, so not everyone is comfortable talking about everything with the whole company, so teams want their private mailing list where they can just they know who is in the mailing list and talk about everything.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes being too open is not good, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, you know, as I alluded to earlier, this is a spectrum. You know, there are going to be situations, circumstances where communication has to be private. We're more focused, more constrained, I guess, might be a better way of saying it. That's a problem if you don't have that open culture set first. Because the culture, the community itself will, if they really understand and appreciate the culture, if they understand and appreciate the importance of open collaboration and open communication, they will self-regulate. They will be smart enough to go, should this be on the public list, or should this be on the private list? And they'll be smart enough to say, you know, and sometimes you see that, you certainly see that a lot on the ASF mailing list. There'll be some thread on the private at, and somebody will say, hold on for a second, I don't see anything on this thread that should be public and that should be private. Let's move it over. So as long as the culture is right, as long as you've got that, and again, I need to really, really stress that, is that culture has to be the primary first foundational aspect to drive inside of this process. After that, those kind of decisions become easier because the community itself, the culture inside there, will allow them to figure out, you know, that's okay. You know, it makes sense to use this private list for that. Jen, can you, so we can be recorded?
A way that we resolve this in the company I work for, especially when we're discussing something that might be a little bit controversial about a direction we want to take, is rather than having a mailing list or a Slack discussion, we'll have an in-person discussion, and without necessarily assigning comments to the person who's made them, it seems really sort of old-fashioned, but we'll just have minutes.
Chat on house
rules. Results of the conversation rather than each person maybe taking the risk of putting themselves out there personally. And we found that works really well. And when we open that up to the larger organization, we get responses back. That's been our sort of middle way so far.
Cool. And I think we have one more question over here. And that I think that's it, really.
Thanks. You had a slide earlier on that company value drives the community.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking that sometimes you have a community that drives the value through innovation. Maybe they invent some new product or service.
Right.
In your experience, is that a management challenge to know how much to drive and how much to just get out of the way?
I think it's a management or company concern. Because it's new, it's different. They don't teach this kind of stuff in business school. You get an MBA, this kind of stuff is new. That's one of the reasons why I like Jim Whitehurst's book about, Jim Whitehurst is the CEO of Red Hat, and he's got this book out. It's the open source company or the open company or something like that. I'm sorry, I can't remember it. But you know, it's basically a summary of his lessons learned. He was the CEO for Delta, I think it was, Delta Airlines, okay? I mean, and then he's now, you know, an open source company, CEO for an open source company. But it addresses that. And it's basically something that CEOs can take from. Capital One, just speaking from my own experience, we were really, really lucky because it was our CEO who decided, you know what, we need to embrace open source and intersource. You know, they were able to see the writing on the wall and said, we need to make this change. But I do think that in the same way that open source was sort of like from the grassroots effort driving up, you're seeing that incredibly amount now, is that, you know, a lot of the desire for this is based on developers and engineers and other people who want to contribute because they've been doing it in the open source. They want to be able to do it internally. Managers are starting to aware that, you know, people are leaving by droves. Companies that are not doing open development, doesn't have a good open source contribution plan and stuff like that. So that kind of like grassroots efforts gets corporate attention because they want to maintain, you know, they want to keep things going and stuff like that.
Do you want to take another question? We're out of our time.
I don't think we have any more time. I'll be around for the rest of the week, so if there are any questions, please don't hesitate to pull me aside and grab me. Again, I encourage you to stay for the next presentation. And thank you, everyone. Enjoy the conference, and gracias.
Thank you.